From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. Brooke Gladstone is out this week. I'm Bob Garfield. After 10 years in the U.S. House of Representatives and more than 16 years in the Senate, for Larry Craig, distinguished gentleman from the state of Ohio, it has come to this.
Idaho Senator Larry Craig, tonight, his explanation.
Let me be clear. I am not gay. I never have been gay.
Tonight, the scandal in the Senate. Powerful Republicans abandon Larry Craig.
On Monday, the Washington area political newspaper Roll Call dropped the bombshell. Craig had been arrested in mid-June by an undercover police officer on suspicion of lewd conduct in a men's room of the Minneapolis-St. Paul airport. Early in August, Craig pleaded guilty to the lesser charge of disorderly conduct, and the nation has since received instruction in the silent signals of the gay man bathroom pickup. What distinguishes this case is that the media have been picking up signals about Craig's sexuality and honesty since 1982, when he preemptively denied sexual involvement with male congressional pages, despite the fact that his name hadn't previously surfaced. Since then, rumors have followed him everywhere. Everywhere, that is, but the Idaho Statesman. The Boise Daily had conducted an investigation of Craig's conduct and truthfulness, but only after the arrest story broke was that piece published. Bill Manny is managing editor of The Statesman, and he joins me now. Bill, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Bob.
Before we get to the details of the current situation, I want to go back to the fall of 2006, when a blogger Michael Rogers reported that the senator was gay. And he justified the outing by saying that Craig was a hypocrite for his anti-gay voting record in the Senate. At that time, I spoke to your colleague at the Spokane Spokesman Review, Steve Smith, about how his paper handled the story. How did the Idaho Statesman deal with the outing at that time?
We talked to Mike Rogers about his story and asked him to provide us with contact information so that we could talk to his sources directly ourselves. We did not believe that his secondhand anonymous reports met our standards for journalism. Mike Rogers was not able to connect us with his sources, and we chose not to report that story. Other newspapers reported the story essentially as the Craig denial and the buzz it had created on the internet. And I don't disagree that there is some news value there. It was a real dilemma.
Yeah, you didn't sit on your hands. You got busy trying to dig into Senator Craig's life to find out what, in fact, was going on. And tell me about the details of that investigation.
Well, we assigned Dan Popke, longtime political reporter and columnist, to find out what was true. Idahoans deserve to know the truth, and if we could determine what it was, we would try to report that. Dan spent about 5 months working on the story. In May, we finally were able to sit down with Senator Craig and lay out what we had found. It was about an hour-long interview at the Craig house with Craig and his wife, and we did play him audio of one of the sources we had describing an encounter this source said was with Larry Craig in a bathroom in Union Station in Washington, D.C. Craig steadfastly denied any and all of the suggestions he was gay or that he'd ever engage in homosexual activity. And then as we considered what we had at that point, we decided we had a he said case, and the word of a longtime distinguished, respected senator ultimately was a deciding factor, and we did not publish.
And then on Monday in Roll Call, the Washington political newspaper breaks the story about the senator's arrest and guilty plea in Minnesota. What happened in your shop when that story broke?
Well, as you can imagine, we were disappointed that a story we had worked so long and assiduously on had been broken by another reporter. You know, you can't beat yourself up too much about a medium-sized paper in Idaho not finding out about a misdemeanor arrest in Minnesota. It's not that we missed it. It's that we weren't even looking. But what we did do quickly was we huddled and decided that we had a story to tell, and this gave us the opportunity to tell it.
Let's just say that Larry Craig is gay, and let us say that his guilty plea was the correct one because he had been cruising a bathroom in the Minneapolis airport. From the perspective of a citizen of Idaho, what's his crime here?
Well, the first point I would say is the crime was what he admitted to and has been sentenced on. So I'm not going to pass judgment on what crime did he commit, because I think he's passed judgment on that himself, and so have the courts. I think this became an issue and a story because since 1982, when Larry Craig issued a preemptive denial that he had been involved in the congressional page scandal involving teenage male pages, it has been a kind of a chronic secondary issue in Idaho politics. Right or wrong, the blogger last fall brought it back to the fore. We owed it to ourselves and our readers to find out what the truth was and then to decide how to print it.
Now, you decided not to run the results of your investigation for some months, and comes the revelation of the guilty plea in Minnesota. Do you now regret the decision not to go with the Craig story that you had when you had it?
We feel today the same way we felt in October and the same way we felt in May, that to go with a story that wasn't complete and was based on the sources we had, it just wasn't ready. I don't think we regret any of the decisions we made along the way.
Bill, thank you.
Bob, thank you very much.
Bill Manny is managing editor of the Idaho Statesman.
I have no specific recollection.
I do not find your testimony credible.
That was Republican Senator Arlen Specter in July questioning the veracity of Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez. The saga of fired U.S. attorneys, strong-arming hospital visits, and warrantless wiretaps took a dramatic new turn this week when Gonzalez announced his resignation, presumably to spend more time with his lawyers.
Today, the ex-chief of staff to Alberto Gonzalez swore under oath that his former boss was wrong when he said he wasn't involved in firing eight U.S. prosecutors last year.
Senator Leahy, this week, Democrats called for a special prosecutor to determine if the Attorney General of the United States, the highest law enforcement officer in the government, has told your committee the truth.
Did the embattled Attorney General actually commit perjury?
For months, controversy of NSA eavesdropping and fired U.S. attorneys has had Gonzalez on the defensive, as he found it impossible to square his sworn congressional testimony with that of subordinates and documentary evidence, such as memos and emails. His claims of sloppy communication, poor memory, and simple misunderstanding have been scoffed at by Democrats and Republicans alike, and duly reported in the press. But in the major institutions of the media, hardly a soul has invoked the term that best describes the failure to tell the truth. The word is lying. New York Times public editor Clark Hoyt has looked at his own paper's use of language in this regard, and he joins me now. Clark, welcome to OTM.
Thank you for having me.
Now, with the resignation of Attorney General Gonzalez, we are simply reminded that through the last number of months, there has been a lot of testimony in Congress which showed that somebody wasn't telling the truth or was wildly misinformed. And we see some reflection of that in the New York Times editorials, phrases like free and loose with the facts and so forth. But the Times and other newspapers seem loath to actually call Gonzalez a liar. Why is that?
Well, I think, first of all, you have to differentiate between the news columns of a newspaper and the editorial columns where opinion is appropriate. My own view is that a news organization should never say in its news columns the word liar. It's such a loaded, judgmental word. It's certainly appropriate to use it if you're quoting someone, but adopting it yourself, I think, leaves you open to all kinds of accusations of partisanship. Several years ago, we had a situation in which the vice president, Mr. Cheney, made a statement about something. And in a news story about that, the very next sentence we put in the story was, I believe the words were, that was not true, and then proceeded to state what the facts were.
What about the verb form, the Attorney General lied, as opposed to, say, dissembled, or some of the other synonyms that tend to get used in place of the L word?
You're stepping into difficult territory here. Do you know that the Attorney General lied? Do you know that he had a remarkably poor memory or even a conveniently poor memory? Do you know that he attempted to mislead without lying? do you know that the president lied or the vice president lied, or do you know that they did not tell the truth? And those are really two different things. The one requires you to read a mind. The other simply requires you to compare what the statement was against the knowable facts. Again, I think that in an argument, in other words, in an editorial, you might choose to use that word. You just quoted one phrase that was used. Another that was used in an editorial was twisted and mutilated the truth beyond recognition. But the word liar, lying, lied, the New York Times, in my observation, I did a quick check, and I found only one instance in relation to the Attorney General.
Well, I must say, you know, I've read the New York Times coverage of the U.S. attorney firing scandal, and I've read the facts arrayed before me and drawn my own conclusions, and my conclusion was that the Attorney General has been lying through his teeth. If I can do it, I don't suppose that your other readers don't have enough information to draw the same conclusion. What do you suppose it is in me that wants me to see the New York Times draw the same conclusion in an editorial and probably the lead one with the headline with the big L word in it?
Well, people want, I think, sometimes more from a news organization than the news organization's prepared to give them or should give them. And I get messages from people all the time, and reading between the lines, they want a result. They're angry about something and they want a result, and they think that the newspaper should provide a result for them. Or they've reached a conclusion about something and they're hungry for the newspaper to validate their conclusion by adopting their view or their language. And I think that our role is to provide information for people to make their own judgments. Sometimes coverage will actually create a result, but quite often that isn't going to happen. And all of us may be frustrated about that, but our job is to lay it out there for people.
Clark, thank you very much.
Bob, thank you.
Clark Hoyt is the public editor of the New York Times. Coming up, the very serious and slightly less serious reasons to run or hold photos. This is On the Media from NPR. This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield. When dealing with contentious arguments surrounding the Iraq War, politicians love to refer us to reports, which ostensibly transcend political rhetoric to give an undistorted view of reality on the ground. Next week, the Government Accountability Office is to release a report assessing the Iraq government's progress in reaching 18 benchmarks put forth by Congress. And of course, there's the much-anticipated September 15th report by General David Petraeus, on which President Bush says our strategy in Iraq should be based. These reports are supposed to give lawmakers, the public, and the press insight into war policy options, but they also give us insight into the war of Republican opinion. This week, an early draft of the report by the Government Accountability Office was leaked for a telling reason. It was feared that the final version would be watered down. Karen DeYoung of The Washington Post was the recipient of the leaked draft, and she joins us now. Karen, welcome to On the Media.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
You explain in your piece in Thursday's Post that the draft concluded that the Iraqi government had failed on all but three of the 18 benchmarks that the Congress had set up, but that the report was leaked by someone who was afraid that, you know, it'd somehow be diminished in its final form. Why would that party have that fear?
Everything about Iraq is contentious at the moment. The fear was, from this person, the concern was, more concern than fear, that once the military in particular got a look at this, they would want to temporize, they would want to qualify some of the conclusions, and they would want to even try to persuade the GAO to change some of its conclusions.
Now, the GAO is supposed to be a nonpartisan investigative arm of the Congress, and it's a Democratic Congress. By what mechanism could a report by its auditors be watered down by the Pentagon or someone else in the administration?
It's standard procedure for the GAO when they write a report to distribute their conclusions before publication, and that's what they did. In this case, they gave a copy to the State Department and to the Defense Department. The idea is that maybe they'll want to bring up some points that the GAO had overlooked. Maybe they'll want to disagree with some of the conclusions. And they give them the opportunity to make that case. Usually those statements by the other agencies are published along with the GAO reports when they're finally published. The State Department more or less said, yeah, we got a few quibbles, but basically, yeah, it's fine. The Pentagon said, well, we don't think that this reflects the most up-to-date information, particularly about the levels of violence and the capabilities of the Iraqi security forces, and we'd like to tell you some more about that. One of the problems is that a lot of what they want to tell them is classified, and so the Pentagon has said now, in the wake of this story, that they expect to see changes in some of the assessments, but we won't see the reasons why they were changed. We won't see the information that was the basis for those changes.
Now, you had a story in Tuesday's Washington Post about the national intelligence estimate that was recently released. And, you know, in the process that you've just described, General Petraeus reviewed it and, according to your story, was able to soften the conclusions. Now, this is the guy who is about to produce the September 15th be-all, end-all report on Iraq war progress. What are we to make of that situation?
Well, I think it's not totally surprising that the National Intelligence Council, which wrote the NIE, asked the military for comment before it was published. I think it is surprising that there were changes made. There were definitely changes made that included some of the statistics that the military has been very interested in publicizing lately about a fall in the overall level of violence over a relatively recent period, a matter of weeks. I think one could argue that what has happened over a period of weeks does not constitute particularly relevant information or a trend within the period that the NIE covers, which is from the beginning of the year through July. The intelligence community has argued that all they did was insert some more updated information that came from the Pentagon, but they certainly did change the report, if not the overall conclusions, that there are not a whole lot of reasons for optimism.
In the battle for how the American public should parse the good news, the bad news, and the even worse news, the September 15th report by General Petraeus has been positioned as kind of the be-all, end-all. The LA Times reported that, in fact, the report isn't going to be written by General Petraeus, but by the White House itself, with consultations with him and Ryan Crocker, the U.S. ambassador to Iraq. When you look at it, will you therefore, you know, sort of evaluate the conclusions differently than you would had it come directly from the military?
President Bush, in talking about this and trying to build support and kind of fend off critics, has repeatedly referred to this as the Petraeus Report. Not surprisingly, because Petraeus, at least if one looks at the polls, has somewhat more credibility than the White House does at the moment. Well, this confuses what the legislation that calls for this report actually says. The legislation calls on the president to deliver a written report to the Congress assessing progress in Iraq. It says that prior to the delivery of that report, General Petraeus and Ambassador Ryan Crocker from Baghdad must testify before the relevant committees in Congress. And I think what you'll see, what you haven't seen in the past vis-a-vis General Petraeus, I think you'll see them kind of taking off the kid gloves with him because the bloom is a bit off the rose in terms of his popularity in Congress. And I think they're going to treat him a little more harshly than they have in the past.
Karen, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Karen DeYoung is an associate editor and senior diplomatic correspondent for The Washington Post and author of Soldier, a biography of former Secretary of State Colin Powell. When the Philadelphia Inquirer's notorious food critic, Craig LeBan, trashed the presumed strip steak at the restaurant Chops, owner Alex Plotkin filed suit. This led to depositions, which were to be recorded on video, which presented a problem for LeBan. Determined to remain unrecognizable to other local restaurateurs, he wore a disguise to the proceedings. The judge would have none of it, ordering LeBan to remove the getup. But the camera-shy critic's problems were just beginning. The story of a business owner claiming libel over defamed meat has captured the city's imagination and that of Philadelphia Magazine, which not only chronicled the dispute, but published a photograph of LeBan. Why expose a man who needs anonymity to ply his trade? Philadelphia Magazine editor Larry Platt is here to tell us. Larry, welcome to On the Media.
Thanks for having me.
All right, let me talk to you about the particulars of the case itself. It began in a capsule review underneath a major review of another restaurant in which LeBan dismissed a steak he had at lunchtime at the restaurant in question as a miserably tough and fatty strip steak. And he's being sued for libel because it was, in fact, not a strip steak, but another cut of meat. And the strip steak is the signature dish at this restaurant. And the owner, a fellow named Alex Plotkin, believes that the business has been materially damaged.
I think that is a fair description, absurdly enough, yes.
What do you make of the libel case? I mean, can you libel a cut of meat?
Obviously, opinion is protected. The restaurateur in this case didn't sue because he didn't like an opinion, he says. He sued because the facts were wrong and the reviewer, Craig LeBan, didn't do his due diligence to check the facts. And so that,
which would possibly constitute a malicious disregard of the facts, which takes you out of the realm of opinion and into news gathering, where even a critic, I suppose, is vulnerable to a libel case.
Exactly.
Should the restaurateur prevail here in a case of of aggravated meat misidentification, how will you feel as a journalist who has to beware of libel in his own publication?
I actually think the libel laws are good in this country, and they keep journalists honest. I believe, and I've throughout my career have learned how much power we have, and I think they are always a good check on the power of the pen. If it comes down to an issue of news gathering, anything that makes reporters more careful, I think, is for the good.
Craig LeBan makes a living as a food critic. He has to go into restaurants and face the people whose work he is reviewing. So anonymity is very important to him. Can you tell me what journalistic purpose is served by printing his photograph?
Sure. He's not really anonymous to begin with, by his own admission. Most of the restaurateurs in Philadelphia have posted in their kitchens photos of him. Media insiders like myself know what he looks like. The only group that doesn't know what he looks like are the readers and the diners. And we have always extended the courtesy to Craig, as to other reviewers, of maintaining anonymity. But something changed, and that was he became part of a news story, and we show the protagonists in our news stories.
Are you sure, by the way, that his photo is in the kitchen or behind the maitre d' podium at every restaurant of any consequence in the Philadelphia area?
Yes, and so was he, by the way. I had a conversation with him before we did this, in which he said, yeah, all the major restaurateurs know what I look like. Some of the mom-and-pops don't, but it's easy to find out. I made 3 phone calls and was inundated with photos of him from kitchens around the city. This whole question of Craig LeBan's anonymity is tied up with a lot of self-importance. I mean, he is not Valerie Plame. This is not an issue. This is not an issue of national security. He's a guy who eats meals and writes about them. Most reviewers in the United States don't do so anonymously. Craig's predecessor at the Inquirer had her picture in the paper for 20-some-odd years.
Now, there's also the aspect of theatricality behind this, because Craig LeBan has appeared in public in various disguises and has been photographed with his face obscured by, I don't know, a bunch of baguettes and so forth. So part of his shtick is that, at least to the public at large, he remains a faceless critic.
We quote Zach Stallberg, the former editor of the Philadelphia Daily News, as saying that basically, the issue of Craig LeBand's anonymity has become something of a gimmick. I'll give you an example. Selling a book, a collection of his reviews, he had a public reading and showed up in elaborate disguise. For the deposition in this lawsuit, he showed up wearing a wig and sunglasses and speaking in a falsetto. The judge apparently made him lose the wig and speak in his normal voice. And like I said, we're not talking about the state of the nation here, and we just felt, why should we be complicit in other media's publicity stunts?
All right. Larry, I appreciate you joining us.
Oh, thank you very much, Bob.
Larry Platt is editor-in-chief of Philadelphia Magazine. When to print a photo can have much more serious ramifications. On August 22nd, the Seattle Times published a surreptitiously taken image of two men standing on a Washington State ferry. Their odd behavior had aroused the suspicions of ferry employees who notified the FBI. But the Bureau needed to identify the men in order to question them and drew a blank. So it took the unusual step of approaching the Seattle media and asking them to publish the photo, not of suspects in a crime, but persons of interest in a potential crime. The Seattle Post-Intelligencer, after careful consideration, declined to cooperate on civil liberties grounds. But after its own deliberations, the rival Seattle Times did publish the picture. Suki Dardarian is the managing editor of news coverage at the Times, and she joins me now. Suki, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
So the FBI calls and says what?
We've got these pictures of these guys who are suspicious. Could you please put them in your newspaper?
And you said, well, of course, sure, send them over. We'll print them up right away. Special edition.
No. We looked at the photographs and we talked about it and made a preliminary call that we wanted to think and talk and report some more. We had actually written a story a few weeks earlier saying that the authorities had stepped up security on the ferry system because there had been some suspicious-looking characters aboard the boats. So we had reported that. What was new on this Monday afternoon was that the FBI wanted to show us these photographs of these people who were identified as suspicious and ask us to put them in the paper.
Now, no crime had been committed.
Correct.
And the photos are men apparently of Middle Eastern descent, so the issue of racial profiling must have been on everybody's mind.
Well, in fact, it's not clear whether they were of Middle Eastern descent. I mean, one could say they might be. They're not blonde men. But more important, these are individuals who were standing on a ferry, and now the FBI was asking us to put those photos out in association with a story that suggested they might be terrorists. So the first thought was the responsibility to these individuals. Were they tourists? Were they students? Were they just interested ferry riders?
And what kind of case did the FBI make to you to suggest that there was more here than met the eye, that this had risen to the level of calling them suspicious characters?
They told us that they had been seen as many as six times on various boats, that people had reported these folks were saying suspicious things and behaving suspiciously, taking pictures, and that that was enough for them. They told us that on Monday night. That wasn't enough, so we held off publishing so that we could really push back and get more information from them. They talked to us further about how they had connected the dots. They gave us more context surrounding the photograph, which had been taken by a ferry employee. They explained to us the deliberation process they went through before they came to us. They actually went to the folks in Washington, D.C. and said, we want to do this. You know, what do you think? They'd never done this before. So we felt that this wasn't a casual request. You know, the other elements out there were the fact that last year our ferry system was singled out by DOJ Inspector General as one of the top two maritime terrorist targets in the country. And 8 years ago, Ahmed Rassam, an Al-Qaeda-trained terrorist, was captured on a ferry coming from Canada to Washington State. He was later convicted of conspiring to set off a bomb at Los Angeles International Airport, and in fact, his trunk at that time was filled with bomb-making materials. So that's sort of the backdrop.
news organizations go to pretty great lengths not to be seen as a tool of law enforcement or any part of officialdom. When you agreed to do this, were there concerns that you had that you were, you know, in effect becoming an arm of the FBI?
You bet. That was one of the things that we put on the scales as we measured what we were going to do. There's a slippery slope. Some suspicious person shows up tomorrow. Are they going to be coming to us asking us to print that photo? And will every police agency do this? So we felt it important to partner those photographs with a story, not only about the photos and the investigation, but that addressed the issue of us publishing the photos as well.
I guess one obvious last question. Has the publication and pretty wide distribution of these photographs turned anything up?
Not that we know of. The FBI tells us they have received almost 300 tips. They are checking them out. They say they're confident that they'll be able to identify these people.
Suki, thank you so much for joining us.
You're welcome.
Suki Dardarian is managing editor of news coverage at the Seattle Times. Coming up, what not to wear with the president on the 4th of July, and other creepy tidbits from the Presidential Advance Manual. This is On the Media from NPR.
Support for On the Media comes from the Kauffman Foundation of Kansas City, the foundation of entrepreneurship, on the web at kauffman.org, the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, helping to build a more just future for the nation and the world at macfound.org, and the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, online at wtgrantfoundation.org. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield. Richard Jewell died this week. Here's Katie Couric.
Back in 1996, the FBI investigated Richard Jewell, an Atlanta security guard, in connection with the Olympic Park bombing in Atlanta. Richard Jewell died today of complications from diabetes. He was 44. Jewell was never charged with any crime. There is much more CBS.
For Richard Jewell, even death didn't end the nightmare. A hero of the Olympic bombing incident, he noticed the bomb-laden backpack placed there by anti-abortion terrorist Eric Rudolph and helped clear the area, Jewell became the focus of the federal bombing investigation. Portrayed as a chubby and pathetic cop wannabe, Jewell was suspected of planting the bomb himself in order to swoop in and save the day. The supposition of FBI profilers was embraced by the media, which barely considered any other scenario. With Rudolph's conviction, Jewell was eventually vindicated, but that word appears not to have reached CBS News. Katie Couric did the unthinkable, writes OTM listener Richard Huffman, who noticed that Rudolph was never mentioned in the CBS story about Jewell's death and, quote, basically seemed to imply that Jewell was the bomber. Also, from our inbox, we heard in droves from both believers and non-believers about our segment God No, which charted the rise of the new atheist movement. Peter Seiler, count him among the non-believers, agreed with our guest that the expression "there are no atheists in foxholes" is offensive to atheists. However, quote, "I think it is even more demeaning to soldiers. The expression says that once you get on a battlefield, the only hope you have is to pray. I believe our soldiers depend more on their equipment, their training, their fellow soldiers, and their leadership than on a mythical supreme being." About our word watch last week on the pejorative use of the term sanctuary city to describe those places with a don't ask, don't tell policy toward illegal immigrants, Andrew S. from Sunnyvale, California, wrote in with a beef. Quote, "Mr. Garfield wonders how it is that a generally positive word, sanctuary, acquired such negative connotations. Just a wild guess here, but maybe it had something to do with the fact that an activist movement used the word sanctuary for an activity that was highly unpopular with the population at large." Maybe so, Andrew, but David Radcliffe of Elgin, Illinois, finds his sanctuary in the Bible. He writes, quote, "Ironic that the conservatives are using sanctuary cities as a negative term. Its biblical roots are of cities set aside to harbor people unjustly accused or on the run from vigilante justice." Radcliffe then cites Leviticus chapter 19, verse 34, which reads, "The stranger who resides with you shall be to you as the native among you." Keep those letters coming. Write to us at onthemedia.org or click on the comments link under individual segments on our website. In the past three decades, only one U.S.-born journalist had been assassinated in the United States for pursuing a delicate story. That changed one morning last month when a man fired three shotgun blasts at reporter Chauncey Bailey nearby his newspaper, The Oakland Post. The alleged gunman was a handyman at Your Black Muslim Bakery, a store connected to racketeering activity that Bailey was investigating. The 57-year-old Bailey, known for his activist journalism and feature pieces, was a fixture in the Oakland black community, which will never have the benefit of his reporting on Your Black Muslim Bakery. But another reporter, Chris Thompson of the weekly East Bay Express, did publish a detailed investigation of the business back in 2002, detailing both the bakery's illegal activities and the lack of intervention by the city's police, politicians, and media. Stephen Buell is the editor of The Express, which he says was immediately subjected to a campaign of intimidation.
When the article was first published, Chris received some threats. We received a brick through our window. We also received, you know, dozens of letters to the editor and just an outpouring of favorable response from our readers who were saying either, wow, I didn't know, or gee, it's about time somebody wrote all that. And over the course of the next year, as we did follow-ups, Chris would continue to get threats. The threats intensified, and we had people basically casing our office, sitting outside in cars, following employees home, asking them if they were the author of the piece. It got to the point where we were legitimately scared. We shared our experience with both the Oakland police, which is where the bakery is located, and the Amityville police, which is the city in which our office is located. Amityville was pretty responsive. Oakland was not responsive. And so ultimately, Chris decided that it made sense for him to work outside our office and indeed our county for 4 or 5 months.
Well, tell me the origins of Your Black Muslim Bakery and how it retained its status as a civic do-gooder in spite of all of the criminal behavior that was swirling around it.
The organization was created in the late 60s or early 70s by a gentleman named Yusuf Bey. It was an offshoot of the Nation of Islam, but pretty quickly kind of went in a different direction. And the initial origins of the group were opening a bakery to provide ex-cons and young offenders fresh out of prison with kind of a way to get back on track, lift themselves up and do it without the assistance of the man or of government. And it was a street-level organization, and in fact, militantly anti-white, but something that was of the community and helping the community. That was the story. Along the way, it turned toward other ends.
Should the police, should the city government, should the media, including the Oakland Tribune, the mainstream daily there, have been aware of what was going on right under its nose?
There were innumerable criminal events, all tied to individuals, not necessarily tied to the organization. The thing that prompted us to do our investigation was the founder of the bakery was charged with 40-some-odd counts of rape and child abuse involving, in several instances, his own foster daughters. So there was a lot of coverage from the Oakland Tribune, from the San Francisco Chronicle, of that story and on television. But there was no real follow-up on the broader picture of this lawless organization. If you took a good look at the organization, it was both political and, you know, religious rhetoric. A couple people associated with the bakery had run for a citywide office. Yusuf Bey ran for mayor. And at the time that he did, he invited in speakers who were, you know, going on and on about the hook-nosed Jews who run our nation. Virulently anti-Semitic, racist stuff. Oakland being the kind of politically correct city that it is, everyone just kind of gave all that stuff a pass.
I'm not sure political correctness is quite the right term, but obviously racial politics is in the very thick of this in a very Tom Wolfe bonfire of the vanities sort of way. Do you think that's so?
Yeah, you're right. And political correctness is an imprecise term at best. The Bay Area is a politically correct, liberal place, and I think there's a lot of media sensitivity to wanting to be inclusive and reach out to every community and not appear to slight, you know, the African-American community, the Muslim community. I think there's been a lot of situations where reporters don't really understand that this black Muslim sect are not in any way Muslims like most of the Muslims we know. So I think this was a hard story for surface coverage to do much justice to because it's very complex and nuanced and the sort of story that the media doesn't often know what to do with.
Now, as of the time Chauncey Bailey was shot to death a few weeks ago, was the Black Muslim Bakery still an ongoing racketeering operation? Were they still operating with impunity? Were they still regarded as a civic asset?
Yusuf Bey died in 2003, and over time, the group became, if it's possible to believe, even more lawless. And even still, the bakery operated as a commercial enterprise, and people went there and ate fish sandwiches and acted like nothing was wrong. As we point out in our paper this week, a bakery-owned security firm has had the security contract for the City of Oakland's Convention Hotel for the better part of a decade, and continues to have that contract in spite of the fact, as we pointed out, in 2002, this organization is not licensed as a security company, has never been licensed as a security company, and is owned by the same people involved in all this violence. So, you know, even in the wake of Chauncey Bailey's assassination, Oakland continues to act like it doesn't care and it isn't inclined to do anything.
You've mentioned you've done some coverage in the last few weeks since Bailey's murder. But before that was this five-year gap. You and Chris Thompson had turned away from your Black Muslim Bakery. Do you wish you'd hung on through all the threats and intimidation?
We did consciously decide to abandon the story about a year after the publication of our original project. I was torn about that then, and I'm torn about that now because there was more to write, and we were basically intimidated into silence. I'll always regret that in some way. I think it was the right decision. I think the tragic murder of Chauncey makes clear that this was, and I believe is, still a dangerous group of individuals, and I didn't want any tragedies on our hands.
Stephen, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you, Bob.
Stephen Buell is the editor of the East Bay Express. It is no secret that White House administrations have always been in the business of managing their public relations, but it's not often that we get documentary proof of the specific strategies they employ. For the current administration, that proof came a couple of weeks ago when its advance manual, a kind of how-to for staging public appearances by the president, was revealed in the course of a lawsuit against a government official. Well, the manual, or at least a heavily redacted version of it, surfaced on the website of the American Civil Liberties Union. Slate senior editor Dahlia Lithwick did a close reading of it, and she joins me now. Dahlia, welcome back to OTM.
Thank you for having me.
Before we get to the what's in the manual itself, let's start with how it came to the surface to begin with. It began with the arrest of a couple called Jeff and Nicole Rank at a presidential event. Tell me about that day.
Sure. It was, believe it or not, a 4th of July event in Charleston, West Virginia in 2004. And it was sort of open to the public on the state grounds. Mr. and Mrs. Rank wore T-shirts to that event. They wore slightly, I think, controversial T-shirts. Each of them had a red circle and a diagonal bar covering the word Bush on the front. And then on the back, his said, "Regime change starts at home," and hers said, "Love America, hate Bush." So, okay, they were trying to Twitter tweak somebody. But they didn't expect, I think, to be handcuffed, booked, photographed, fingerprinted, charged with trespassing of all things, held for several hours in jail in West
Virginia. Wait. I'm sorry. Trespassing at a public event? I guess the loitering statute wasn't available.
Right. And they didn't jaywalk. It was an incredibly bogus charge. They were released after a few hours and the city apologized. But the real question is a question that's been raised in several other lawsuits about what happens at these Bush events, at sort of public speeches and visits. This is not a campaign event. This is him in his capacity as the president. There was a funny quote that I read where Mr. Rank said that God Bless America was playing on the loudspeakers as they dragged him off in handcuffs. I haven't been able to corroborate that. But, it's certainly meant to be a 4th of July event. And yet this is deemed inappropriate demonstrating and is actionable. So the Ranks not unreasonably sued. This lawsuit has sort of gone back and forth and up and down in all sorts of directions, but it was finally settled a few weeks ago with the Bush administration paying $80,000. Let's note that that's taxpayer money to the Ranks, and the case has now been dismissed.
But the manual survives. It's a set of how-to instructions for, I guess, keeping the crowd a friendly one. What's in it?
The manual turned up as part of discovery in this lawsuit, and as you pointed out in your intro, it's been very heavily redacted. So we probably are missing the really, truly delicious bits. I think that's fair to say, but it's called the Presidential Advance Manual. There's an enormous amount in here that is quasi-hysterical about, quote, demonstrators and protesters. And it very much starts to look, at least the unredacted parts, as though the whole object of these things is to do whatever you can to sort of quell protected free speech.
There's actual language in there that talks about tactics for, quote, deterring potential protesters from attending events. And one of the means for doing so, rally squads. What are rally squads?
Rally squads, the manual suggests that the organizers of this event drum up, quote, college/young Republican organizations, local athletic teams, and fraternities/sororities, and then have these rally squads, quote, use their signs and banners as shields between the demonstrators and the main press platform. And then later on they say, quote, long sheet banner could be used, quote, in strategic areas around the site. So you sort of have this idea of like a bunch of Sigma Nu guys with an enormous sheet swarming any potential protesters.
Okay, now it's not just that they want to quell voices of dissent. There's also the sensitivities of Dear Leader.
There's language that says that only individuals and groups, quote, that are extremely supportive of the administration, now that extremely is underlined in the manual, end quote, are going to be seated in the area between the stage and the main camera platform. So only, you know, the people who are going to be like absolutely hysterical with love for the president get to sit around him and in front of the cameras. And then there's, an even sort of slightly more alarming quote in the manual where they actually have event staff that are creating protest areas, quote, preferably not in view of the event site or the motorcade route.
Free speech pens.
Right. Those that aren't going to be sort of clapped behind the knees and dragged off in cuffs. Those who are in fact permitted to speak are going to have to do it in some area where not only the cameras don't see, maybe in some universe that makes sense, but fascinatingly enough, the president himself is to be shielded from it. You know, is he really, really so sensitive that he can't see people who disagree with him?
Is this really limited to the Bush administration, or shouldn't we suppose that the Clinton administration used similar tactics?
You know, that's a good question. And in researching this piece, I did come across a few instances where there was some quelling of speech at Clinton events and people who brought lawsuits. It seems to me that the difference is, and again, we don't know, maybe there was a similar advance manual coming out of the White House under the Clinton era. But one of the things that is interesting is how sort of systemic this is and how focused, again, it is. I think that is quite a different thing.
You know, it's got more than a little tinge of North Korea to it, doesn't it?
It really does, I think, chill you a little bit to imagine that a T-shirt could send event staff into orbit in this country in this day and age. It's just so profoundly un-American. We're joking about it, but I do think it goes to the heart of this question of how is it possible that this administration is so protected from dissent that it just literally doesn't hear it.
All right, Dahlia. Thank you very much.
Okay, that's quite a beleaguered sigh.
Dahlia Lithwick is senior editor at the online news magazine Slate. That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Megan Ryan, Jamie York, Mike Vuolo, Mark Phillips, and Nazanin Rafsanjani, and edited this week by me. Dylan Keefe is our technical director, and Jennifer Munson, our engineer. We had help from Andrea Ambrose and Madeline Ellish. Our webmaster is Amy Pearl. Katya Rogers is our senior producer, and John Keefe, our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. You can find free transcripts, MP3 downloads, and our podcast at onthemedia.org, and email us at onthemedia@wnyc.org. This is On the Media from WNYC. Brooke will be back next week. I'm Bob Garfield.
On the Media is supported by the Bidell Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, the John and Anna Maria Phillips Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.
On Notes from America, we have conversations with people across the country about how we can truly become the nation that we claim to be. Each week, we talk about race, our politics, education, relationships, usually all of them, because everything's connected. And you, our listeners, are at the center of those conversations. I'm Kai Wright. Join me on Notes from America, wherever you get your podcasts.